Shadows, a Clark Ashton Smith podcast.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Season 2 wrap-up of Strange Shadows, the Clark Ashton Smith podcast. In this episode, we're going to be looking back over the last series of favourite stories, favourite words, and all manner of weird and wonderful Smithian bits and pieces. I'm one of your hosts, Tim Mendes.
And I'm the other one, Rob Poynton. Yeah, we're going to be dipping into some of the letters as well from our various tomes. And also answering some questions. We've had quite a few comments in over the series. We do apologise for those that we don't get to answer straight away. Sometimes we miss them. Sometimes the episode has already been recorded. So we've got a few of those to catch up on as well. But I do believe we're going to start, as always, with our favourite word section.
Indeed, yeah. I did have fun going back through my notes. It was a bit tricky because I must have switched notebooks at one point during the thing. So I've been going up by like three or four different notebooks this morning.
I'm the same.
Yeah. Right. Well, my first one I think I'm going to go for is, I believe it was from the Good Embalmer, as rubicund, which is ruddy or rude.
Oh, very nice. Rubicund's got a very nice, rolls around the tongue, doesn't it, that one?
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
My first couple are, Smith used a lot of those sort of very old-fashioned words or words that have fallen out of use.
Yeah.
And my first one of those is from the City of the Singing Flame, Percy, P-U-R-S-Y, which means obese.
Nice.
So if someone's looking a bit Percy, don't say it to their face. We'll have no body shaming here.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, my next one, again, it's an archaic term, basically. And I believe it's from An Offering to the Moon. I'm not entirely sure because this is one that I'd wrote the notes for one story across two notebooks. So I'm not entirely sure. But basically, it means full moon, plenilune.
Oh, plenilune. That's lovely, isn't it?
Plenilune. It's a great word, isn't it? It's for musical almost.
Yes. It almost sounds like a musical term, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
Or some archaic instrument.
Yeah.
He was a master of the plenilune.
Indeed.
The zither. Yeah. And my second archaic term is from The Kiss of Zoraida. And this is one you were familiar with, I believe, but I'd never heard before. Collops.
Ah, yes.
Which was sliced meat, I believe.
Yes, slices of meat, yeah.
Yeah, never heard that before.
It's still used in butchery, but, it was back when I trained, which was like the 1990s, but it's not really been, you don't really hear it anymore. Yeah. Right, my next one is, it's actually from the Renaissance, as morbidezza. It's an artistic concept describing a natural delicacy in flesh tones. It also means soft, weak, or effeminate.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah, morbidezza.
And then I've gone for a couple of words that I just like the sound of. And the first one is from the Gorgon. And I think this is a quality that everyone should have, particularly musicians and us arty types. And the word is fabulosity.
Oh, I knew you were going to go for that. I saw when I was going through.
I'm so predictable.
Well, no, because I went through the list of the episodes on Buzzsprout and where you've got them listed. Fabulosity. I bet Rob says, because I seem to remember you liking that one.
I just feel like, sometimes you can overwhelm someone with your fabulosity.
Now, sticking with probably what is very predictable, my next one is a naughty term.
There we go.
Yeah. Polyandry.
Which
is a woman with more than one husband, or a pattern of mating where a female animal has more than one mate.
Wow.
So it's basically an archaic term for a spit roast.
Oh, for our non-UK listeners, well, I don't know. I'm making an assumption there. Don't Google it. Don't image search. Don't image search. Yeah, especially, well, not if you're at work anyway.
Don't image search. Yeah.
And my last one, which is from Rendezvous Navarroine, which was packed full of wonderful terms.
Oh, yeah.
And this is the opposite of fabulosity, really. Hebetude, which is lethargy.
Ah.
So, my fabulosity is waning today. I'm in a state of hebetude.
Oh, I like it. I like it. Yeah, for my last one, I thought it was only fitting because a lot of Smith's best words and phrases are to do with colour. So I thought I'd go my personal favourite, which is fulvous.
Fulvous, yeah.
Yeah, which is a dull orange, brownish yellow, or tawny.
Tawny. That's not a word you hear much now, is it? Tawny.
No, unless you're talking about owls, I guess.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
Or port. Tawny port.
Tawny port, yeah.
Do you see tawny port anymore? I do like a drop of tawny port.
It does sound like a porn actress name to me.
It does a bit, doesn't it? Tawny port. Yeah. Well, the tone of this episode has already hit rock bottom.
Well, you know, when you hit rock bottom, there's only one place to go, and that's even further down.
Even further, yeah. Subterranean.
Yeah. All right, moving swiftly on. So let's look at what our favorite. We'll just pick one favorite story each, I think.
Oh, okay, that's tricky.
It is, isn't it? And maybe we'll look at our least favorite as well, which I think is probably going to be the same for both of us.
Yeah.
But I'm interested to hear what your favorite would be out of this collection.
That's interesting because, yeah, I mean, the obvious choices are going to be Return of the Sorcerer and The Hunters for the Beyond for me. Because I've read them before, so I knew what I was getting out of them. I think the one that surprised me pleasantly the most was probably The Kingdom of the Worm.
Mm.
I really enjoyed that. I know it was one of them stories where there was not a hell of a lot happens, but it's just the atmosphere to it. It was just like quintessentially Smith for me. It was really grim, you know, really grim, really sort of cloying atmosphere. Some nice descriptions of like charnel and decay and all this kind of stuff. I don't know why. It just stuck with me.
And that really is a top-notch Weird Tao title, isn't it? The Kingdom of the Worm. You know, it's like the shadow from beyond or the lurker in the crypt. Or it really does capture that vibe. Yeah.
Yeah, I pinched it for a song title.
Oh, right. Yeah, well, yeah, good song title. Yeah, good album title. Yeah,
exactly.
I can see that. Yeah. Well, I'm going to go for the Testament of Athamaeus. Athamaeus.
Athamaeus.
And again, it's a difficult one because there are so many good stories in this. But for me, this was peak Smith in terms of the language used was the first thing.
Yeah.
And the second thing was, although in one sense this is a story about a rather weird occurrence, it's also a history in a way. It's the history of the fall of Camorium.
Yeah.
Because this is why Camorium fell into, well, it was abandoned basically and left to this monster, this creature. So you get a bit of sort of Hyperborean lore, if you like, and history and world building, but not particularly presented as such, presented in the form of these are the events. I thought that was nice because other times authors can put in lore and it's like a little line here and there. And that's something Smith does very well as well. We've spoken about with his world building.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, it was like when I was reading it and I sort of realised, oh, this is like a prequel to September Zeros.
Yeah, well, that's exactly the other thing. The third thing for me was the fact that this is a prequel without being, it's not at all set up as a prequel.
No.
And you don't have to have read September Zeros to get this story or anything else, you know. It stands alone. Yeah, it just, yeah, of course, this is the history of Satampra Zeros, or, you know, why when they go to the city to find the temple and loot it, why it's all been abandoned. And furthermore, we speculated, I think with some justification, that what they meet, the formless spawn they meet and is their doom, is this character from this story.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it seems quite obvious, really, when you think about it.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's the only thing left there. So then years and years later, when September Zeros goes to it, you know, it makes sense, doesn't it? It just fits really neatly. And I think these are my favourite kinds of prequels and sequels, the ones that aren't explicitly like carrying on straight away or right up to it. They are standalone. And I mean, it's something I do a lot in my work, but a lot of my stories are kind of prequels and sequels to other ones, but you'd never know unless you sat down and read them, kind of thing, you know.
Well, it is nice to do that, and I think especially because it's not signposted in any way. This isn't, do you remember the tale of Sir Tamprazeros? Well, let me tell you how, there's none of that, you know, you're just straight in.
Mm.
And what a fun thing to do, and I've done it myself to some extent in my Wolf novels, where I've written a couple of short stories with not the main character from the story, but someone who appears in one of the novels.
Yeah.
So then they get a little, oh, this is how that guy became a general at the Imperial Court.
Yeah, or, you know, that's my favourite thing to do. Take sort of an incidental character, like a librarian or, you know, just some spod from the story and spin something off around them, you know.
Yeah, and Smith does that masterfully here. And I think in this, there were so many bits in this story I wanted to read out. But I just want to read one paragraph because, you know, This is Smith. It was some of his best writing, I think. So this is Athamaeus himself, of course, is the narrator of the story. My sinews have dwindled grievously now, and time has drunken stealthily from my veins and has touched my hair with ashes of suns extinct. But in the days whereof I tell, there was no braver and more stalwart headsman than I in the whole of Hyperborea, and my name was a red menace, a loudly spoken warning to the evildoers of the forest and the town, and the savage robbers of uncouth outland tribes. Wearing the blood-bright purple of my office, I stood each morning in the public square where all might attend and behold, and performed for the education of all men my allotted task. And each day, the tough, golden, ruddy copper of the huge crescent blade was darkened not once, but many times, with a rich and wine-like sanguine. And because of my never-faltering arm, my infallible eye, and the clean blow which there was never any necessity to repeat, I was much honoured by the king Lochwamethros and by the populace of Comorium. And I think that's just a fine example of how in a single paragraph, it's just so evocative. You can see this. You know what's happening. You get a real sense of everything that's going on and the purpose and the motivations of this character all wrapped up in that. You know?
Yeah, and you've got to love the fact that basically this beautiful language, he's basically talking about execution. As well.
This is it. Yeah, totally. It's that juxtaposition. Yeah. And I mean, it goes into detail on the executions in this, right? And I know at the time we spoke about historical executions, didn't we?
Yeah, Pierpoint and people like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And the headsman's block and the Lord Lovett, who was the last person to be executed with that block, who laughed heartily when the stand collapsed, killing a lot of onlookers to his execution.
Yes, indeed.
And I was up at Leeds recently, and there's a place there called the Leeds Armouries Museum, which is a lot of military and various other bits and pieces.
Yeah.
And I was a bit disappointed because in the blurb, they said they had that block there.
Oh, right.
Because a lot of their stuff came from the Tower of London. So they had the block, an executioner's sword, all that kind of thing in the catalogue. But when I looked around, it wasn't there.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah, a certain amount of the stuff has been taken back to the tower. Mm. So... I was quite disappointed I didn't get to see an executioner's block.
If you're ever down in Bury St. Edmunds, there's a bunch of stuff like that. There's the Museum of Witchcraft and I can't remember, witchcraft and something else. But it basically, murder and witchcraft. So you've got all stuff from the witch trials and you've got all the, that's where, you know, the Red Barn murder.
Oh, yeah.
The murderer's scalp is there, and the book that was made out of this skin is there, and there's gibbets and things like on all this like authentic stuff. So yeah, if you ever want to see some really grisly stuff, that's the place to go.
I'll have to pay a visit because that's not that far from me.
It's an awesome place. You can go and check out that pub with the mummified cat while you're there. And
Yeah. Because remember, you did a video on it, didn't you?
We'll put
a link up to that below. And funny enough, the last time I was over that way was when I did an Innsmouth excursion as well to Woolpit, which has the Legend of the Green Children.
Ah, nice.
That's just down the road from Bury St. Edmunds.
So. Yeah. And obviously, just down the road again, you've got where M.R. James grew up. So.
Oh, yeah. And you know, that part of England, you've got there's a lot of stuff going on. Bawley Rectory is not that far away. Black Shucks. Yeah.
Incredible place. Really interesting. Mm.
So those are our favourite stories. So I suspect, like most number ones, that, you know, that can change given the amount of good stuff.
Well, I think, you know, I'll always come back to The Hunters from Beyond. It's one of my favourite Smiths of all time. But I think in this kind of context, because I'd never read that one before, it really stood out to me. Whereas I've read Hunters several times, but same with Return of the Sorcerer. I think that's the one I've read the most of Smith's, because I think it's been the most reprinted. Right. I mean, right. Yeah, don't quote me on that, but I think it's the most reprinted story of Smith's.
Yeah.
Because it's the one that always gets picked up for Cthulhu Mythos anthologies. So, yeah.
In terms of stories that we didn't like so much, I think we're going to be looking at the science fiction tales, aren't we, really?
Yeah.
And I think for me, probably something like an Adventure in Futurity.
I was going to say it's an Adventure in Futurity for me.
Yeah. Which was that the longest story he ever wrote? I think
yes, at the time. It was. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is basically a novella.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is a shame given that it's not a bad story or anything like that. And there are some nice splashes of colour in there. But it's not something I'd rush to read again.
No, it's interesting because if you put it up against most other sci-fi writers, it's a great story.
Yeah.
It's just in terms of Smith's overall work, it's sort of the lesser so far, anyway, for me anyway.
Yeah.
Don't know, there was just something about it. It was almost like he was just going through the motions. That's how it felt to me.
And I think you mentioned at the time that idea of we got to a cliffhanger. So the whole planet's going to be destroyed by a strange disease and it's all build up. And, oh, we've got a cure for it.
Yeah.
And that was it. Yeah,
exactly.
It was a sort of anticlimactic, wasn't it? Pretty much all the way through that happened a few times.
Yeah, it really felt like it was written for serialization. Because it did remind me of those old, like the old Doctor Who serials where at the end of the episode, there'd be in mortal peril. And then at the beginning of the next episode, it'd get wrapped up in some really sort of easy kind of way. Like somebody just shut the door or press a button or something like that, you know. A lot of them did feel like cop-outs, right? But at the time, as you're a kid, you don't really care. But, you know, it felt a bit like that to me.
I suppose that was standard fare at the time. Well, actually, all his science fiction stories put me in mind of Flash Gordon a bit. The older, is it Buster Crab and all that kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Now, we did speculate, and you certainly said it, that you had the feeling that Smith didn't enjoy writing the science fiction stuff so much. Well, I've been delving through the archives. Well, I say archives. I've been going through Dawnwood Spire, Lonely Hill, which is the letters between Smith and Lovecraft, 1922 to 31, edited by David E. Schultz and S.T. Joshi. And as we say every time we mention this, if you're a Smith or Lovecraft fan, you really want to get hold of a copy of this. It's just absolutely, it's over 300 pages of, well, I mean, some of the Lovecraft letters are like 15 pages long, you know, it's incredible.
Well, there's two volumes, isn't it? Because I've got volume two. But that's mostly the appendices, so it's got all Smith's crosswords and some really weird and wonderful stuff, which are great for the bonus episode.
So I'm going to read a couple of sections from this letter, and then we get into that confirmation. This is dated 21st of October 1930 from the Calaspian Mountains in the Hyperborea of the future. Is it Hyperborea or Hyperborea?
I've always said Hyperborea, but Hyperborea. That's just my sort of northern tendency to flatten the vowels.
I think Hyperborea sounds better, but well, you know us and pronunciation.
Yeah.
Dear H.P.L., I am marvellously pleased and enchanted by your new story, which is a most worthy compeer of the Call of Cthulhu and the Dunwich Horror, and serves to constitute with these a monumental trilogy. You certainly make something very haunting out of the Vermont scenery and atmosphere, and the story itself and the creatures from Yuggoth and their activities are superlatively ingenious and imaginative. So this is the Whisperer in Darkness.
It's got to be Whisperer, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad that Wright is paying you a fair price for the story. He would have deserved transportation to an even more disagreeable milieu than Yuggoth if he had rejected it. I bet he must have wished sometimes he could have sent Wright to Yuggoth.
Oh, I bet he did, yeah.
So then we get onto this a couple of paragraphs later. I finished an offering to the moon, which I think you will like. Also, an ungodly piece, pseudo-Oriental junk, The Kiss of Zoraida, for submission to Wright's New Magazine. And obviously, we covered that in this series.
Yeah.
We thought it was okay. I seem to remember.
Yeah, no, I quite enjoyed that one. Yeah.
Now I must revise The Red World, if I can, and do some more novelettes. So, and then we get to the relevant point here. But I would vastly prefer to write tales of the supernatural and the purely fantastic, like Averroine. Its pretense of being scientific gives me a pain. The mythology of science is not one that intrigues me very deeply. So there we go, straight from the horse's mouth. We're absolutely spot on with that observation.
Yeah. Right. So we were spot on, yeah. Right, that does make a lot of sense, because that was something I said, wasn't it? It feels like he's just kind of going through the motions. It's obviously it's stories to pay the bills at this point, right? You know, because you get that impression with the Volmar stuff, because that was the first time he'd been asked to write more of a certain thing, and you get the impression his heart's not fully into it.
Yeah, so you get those occasional splashes of colour, but also there was that constant pressure to write more action in as well, wasn't there, which they talk about a lot in the letters. And Smith could do action, but there's action and there's Smithian action, isn't there? You know? And you get the feeling he was being a bit straitjacketed into doing sort of mainstream action, fist fight, laser gun battle kind of stuff.
Yeah. It's that's what I mean. It's like, you know, some, like with these descriptions of some of the creatures and things like that, you can tell he's having fun there.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why it feels almost jarring to a degree when you get to sort of some like mundane thing of a guy whips out his laser and blasts a bit, and then a flying saucer comes and picks them up kind of thing.
Yeah. I think that's something else we spoke about at the time, and I think possibly that was in one of the other letters as well, about how the interesting thing in that situation is a person's reaction to seeing a huge walking, bug-like, multicoloured thing. And in the action story, you see a big, huge, walking, multicoloured, bug-like thing, and you shoot it dead.
Yeah, I mean, a great example is City of the Singing Flame, right? I mean, that's basically the whole gist of that story, is him being surrounded by these weird and wonderful creatures and his reaction to these weird and wonderful creatures and the strange phenomena that's sort of going on around him. You know, this, because it's an endless procession, right, of these creatures coming to throw themselves into the flame.
Yeah, from all over the universe or multiverse. Yeah. But also interesting in that, you get their reaction to him as well.
Indeed. Which I thought was really cool. That's sort of one thing I really like about that story. That was another contender for my favourite.
Absolutely. And I think, it's the action thing, if you think back to, it's the old sort of Starship Troopers thing, and it's an alien blast you know, which was handled so very well in the film.
Yes. Well, which, satire, wasn't it?
Which was a total satire on Heinlein, and his, I gather his attitudes were rather, well,
yes,
militaristic,
less authoritarian.
It's not an author I'm that familiar with, so I shouldn't really say anything, but they certainly reversed that, or they showed that up in the film very well. Whereas Smith would have had the characters interacting with those aliens and interacting in perhaps quite interesting ways.
Indeed, which we've had a few times, haven't we? Daughter Saturn and things like that, you know. Bit of a multi-interspecies rumpy-pumpy going on, you know.
Oh, one other thing I was going to say alongside that, because this is something that's come up a few times, is a possible reason why Smith never gained a popularity of Lovecraft and Howard was he never really had a central or reoccurring character that people could look to, and they think like Conan or Tarzan or something like that. I mean, I know to an extent Howard didn't either, but then he sort of did in Cthulhu.
Yeah, the mythos was the returning element, wasn't it? Yogg-Sothoth, all this kind of stuff. That's what people spotted in the stories. They go, oh, you know, Yogg-Sothoth, Necronomicon. It's like, yeah, his main recurring character is probably the Necronomicon, right?
Yeah. Across pretty much all his stories, but maybe with the exception of some of the earlier ones, the mythos or mythos related is a core theme in all of them. Smith, we get a mixture of stories, a mixture of settings and times and places. And we do get one or two reoccurring characters like Volmar and Hastane. Then here's the question, and I'd be interested to hear what our listeners think of this. Volmar and Hastane, what do they look like?
Yes.
Right? If I say Tarzan, everyone knows.
Yeah.
Right? Or Conan or Solomon Kane or whatever. So these I can't imagine. I have an image of them, but that's my own image. I can't think that Smith ever really described them.
That's really interesting. No, well, it's like the whole crew of the Volmar ether ship thing. I don't think there was really any description of them all. I mean, because I'm picturing them in spacesuits made of tweed, you know. And again with Hastane, I think there may have been like a couple of like lines maybe about his eyebrows or something, you know, something small like that.
Yeah.
I mean, because to me, again, I'm sort of putting my own visualization onto it. And I picture him as the Peter Cushing from the movies, Doctor Who.
Yeah.
You know, this almost grandfatherly kind of, almost a dandy-esque with the, you know, the white hair and the pince-nez kind of job.
Yeah.
I mean, but, yeah.
I mean, in some ways, you can almost read him as a Doctor Who-like character. I think, especially, as you say, the Peter Cushing movie one. He was the granddad, wasn't he?
He was literally the granddad. But that's I think that's why I've got that in my head, because the last one we read with him in it reminded me that the whole just whipping up this contraption and all that kind of stuff, it reminded me of that. It really did. Yeah, because the movie Doctor Who, he's not a Time Lord. He's just this eccentric old sod who's built a time machine in his shed, basically.
Out of Meccano and
bits of string.
A couple of gyroscopes.
Picturing it with that, you know, that orange hairy string that you always used to get granddads always had in their pocket, you know, that baling twine.
Yeah, baling twine, and a lock knife,
there you go.
Did you ever have a gyroscope as a kid?
Yes.
I remember having one of those, and you pull it and it spins around, and I thought, now what?
Yeah, I know, You pull the ripcord thing out of it, it spins about a bit, and then it's like, oh, right, great.
I've not gone back to the Jurassic era or anything. This is quite dull. When Peter Cushing spins it, he ends up fighting Daleks.
You know? Yeah, I know, right? I feel a bit cheated.
Yeah, so I just wonder what people think on that. You know, Smith, like Lovecraft, wasn't a character writer as such. We could be unkind and say that Howard wrote several versions of the same character. You know, there's an element of truth in that. But nonetheless, he wrote very vivid characters.
Yeah.
You know, Solomon Kane is not the same person as a Bram McMahon or whatever.
No. He had an archetype. But
Yeah. They were generally steely thewed, weren't they?
Bulging of muscle.
And you know, we've said this before about Lovecraft in the Innsworth Book Club, of course, that aside from Randolph Carter, there's no recurring human character, though Nyarlathotep pops up quite a lot and the ghouls pop up quite a lot. And Cthulhu only appears in one story. Interesting.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. I've always found that interesting that he's been like the really enduring one, where it's like, you know, even calling it the Cthulhu mythos, because Lovecraft himself called it Yog-Sothothery.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Cthulhu was, I wouldn't say like a minor figure, but Yog-Sothoth was the, and I'd argue Nyarlathotep as well.
Yes, very much so.
Perhaps because of his fascination with ancient Egypt. And I suspect from a writing perspective, Nyarlathotep can interact with humans because he can take all those different forms.
Yeah. You know. Well, Nyarlathotep is the one that occurred the most.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, interesting stuff.
And that comes back to that idea again of your aliens, right? You can have a human interaction with Nyarlathotep. Just to even see Cthulhu send you mad. And
exactly. And Yog-Sothoth is basically loads of iridescent spheres.
It's a load of balls.
A load of balls. Yeah. Yeah.
No, Sothoth, he's just a load of balls. I suppose it just wasn't Smith's thing to have a character-driven story in that way. That wasn't his. You know, he
indeed
writes yeah. and creates incredible visions and incredible atmospheres and darkly twisted plots.
Yeah,
which is those are the core of the story rather than the character, I suppose.
Yes, I think that probably makes sense. Yep.
Let's move on to our letters then. And Tim, you've been doing some deep delving into some correspondence with people I wasn't even sure that I knew about, actually. It's very interesting.
Yeah, I went down a rabbit hole. Basically, I had this idea when I woke up this morning about looking at... It's one of those ideas I'm kicking myself that I didn't have months ago. But in the next series, I will do this going along. I was looking at, like, thinking about contemporary reviews, like to try and get an idea of what people at the time thought of Smith's work. And to this end, I came across a book called The Freedom of Fantastic Things, which was released in 2006, published by Hippocampus and edited by Scott Connors, who was one of the guys who did the volumes that we're going through. And basically, it's a lot of essays and critical stuff and sort of all that kind of stuff. But there is a section on contemporary reviews. Unfortunately, most of them are about his poetry. But in that, there was a really interesting letter. And the letter is from H.P. Lovecraft to F. Lee Baldwin. Now, Baldwin was a writer from Assateague in Washington. He was a fan of weird fiction who set up the fanzine The Fantasy Fan, which published several of Smith's stories. Yeah. He also wrote the first biographical articles on H.P. Lovecraft. And he corresponded quite a lot with Lovecraft himself. And this letter is from Lovecraft to Baldwin, is dated the 27th of March, 1934. And it's really, there's some really interesting stuff in here. The excerpt starts, "Yes, I would certainly like to meet Smith, who is in some ways the most unusual person I know. I've been a close correspondent of his since August 1922, when I was put next to him by my friend Samuel Loveman, who in turn got in touch with him through the late poet George Sterling. Smith was born in Auburn, California, 1893, and has never been out of his native state. He lives with his parents in a cottage on a hillside somewhat outside Auburn Village, within easy access of a rather weird type of mountain scenery, Crater Ridge, which figured in his story, The City of the Singing Flame." Then he goes on to talk about, like, Smith being, you know, in a state of pecuniary depletion.
we have to get that in.
Yeah. Well, he talks a lot about his early days and the fact that his family were quite impoverished. And then it talks about his publishing The Star Treader and things like that. And then he mentions his ill period and a few bits and pieces like that. And the fact that he learned French and then translated Baudelaire, which Lovecraft says are the best I have ever seen, although they have not yet found a publisher. Smith has read the magazine Weird Tales from the start and was the first to direct my attention to it. At the period, he did not expect to contribute to it, but on my urging, he sent in several poems, many of which were accepted. I kept urging the editors, first Edwin Baird and then Wright, to use his work, but they were very slow to respond. Indeed, it was not until this year that any picture of his was accepted. His new period of fiction writing was very slow in developing. In 1925, he wrote Sad Astor and The Abominations of Yondo, but Wright rejected both. Not until about 1930 did he become prolific and persistent in bombarding editors. Then his success as a fictionist began quite suddenly, both Weird Tales and the science fiction magazines accepting his tales in unlimited quantity. This unfortunately caused him to write many cheap hack tales, but such potboiling has never spoiled his real style. When he sets out to write something really serious, he does it. His pictorial work would require a chapter in itself. Some of his hideous heads, proboscidean, semi-reptile, semi-insect, are classics of their kind, and no one excels him in drawing unearthly, abnormal, and poisonous vegetation. It's very true, isn't it? His large landscape scenes on Saturn and on still remoter worlds are full of mysterious spell. If you'd like to see some of Smith's smaller drawings, I'll gladly lend you those in my possession. As soon as their present borrower returns them, I've met two people who've seen Smith face to face, one friend of his in Auburn who visited the East last year, and one Easterner, George Kirk, who visited him in California in 1921. He is very kindly and likable, and incredibly brave in his lifelong struggle against illness, poverty, and misunderstanding. Well, that's a really lovely little biographical sketch of Smith, isn't it?
It is, and that sums up his work and the man, doesn't it? So concisely and precisely as well.
Yeah, well, there is more. He does go on like more sort of like his life things. But if I was to read, because it's Lovecraft, it's about six pages long, so I'd be here all day.
I was thinking that first visitor to the East would have been Miss Sully, wouldn't it?
Indeed. Yes,
and
indeed.
Miss Sully's daughter, I think it was, who Lovecraft regaled with a vampire story in the local cemetery and frightened her.
Creeped her out of a graveyard. Good man. Yeah, so after I'd found this, and I was sort of disappointed, I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll go through the issues of Weird Tales after Smith had been published. Right. And this is what I will do in future now. I'll look at the letters in the following issues in the publications to see if there was any mention of the stories, because I think it'd be really interesting to find out what people say.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Obviously, I couldn't go back through all of them today because it would take far too long. But there were some good ones that I discovered. The first ones are from the July 1931 issue of Weird Tales. And they're in the Eerie section, which was a letters section. Uh-huh. And they're concerning a rendezvous in Averoigne. The first one is from Mexico City. Alice Lianson writes, "As was to be expected, my favourite story in the April-May issue is A Rendezvous in Averoigne. It is a gem of fantasy, beautifully worded, dreamily weird, soul-thrilling and satisfying. I hope there are many others to follow like this and the end of the story." See, what I found really interesting about this is Wright's sort of reticence to publish Smith's work, saying it's too weird. But that story was actually voted the best in the issue.
And this seemed to be quite a common thing, right, from what we've read so far.
Yeah.
It'd be first or second, it'd be one of the top stories in the issue.
Yeah, exactly.
And yet he faced this constant battle to be, less weird for Weird Tales.
Yeah, because I found as well that the Testament of Athenaeus was voted second behind Jack Williamson's The Wand of Doom.
Right.
Another letter from Toppinish, Washington. Mrs. Grace Penfield. That's a great name, isn't it? That's like something out of Agatha Christie. Right. "One story in your April-May issue had brought me the urge to write to you. It is A Rendezvous in Averoigne by Clark Ashton Smith. To me, the perfect weird tale must ring true and must be weird to the nth degree. This story fills both bills. The writer tells a tale in such a manner that you feel it all the way through. And having some of the good old Irish banshee-believing blood in my veins, truth to tell, he had me almost believing it. Even though he relates the end of the Sieur de Malinbois, I don't know how we pronounced that at the time, and his chatelaine, sure, and you'll never catch me in the wood of Averoigne at all. I am looking forward to more by this author." I love that at all, just to make sure that we know she's Irish.
Oh, my word. But how nice for Smith to see that, because this is something we were talking about the other day, funnily enough. As a musician, you get to experience your audience firsthand.
Indeed, yeah.
Which can be a good thing or it can be
a blessing or a curse, right?
Right. But you get that immediate reaction. Yeah, it was an interview with someone and they were saying they never went to the premiere of their films because they hated sitting in an audience watching the film in case the audience didn't like it. I think it was Sylvester Stallone, actually, when he wrote Rocky.
Yes.
And he didn't want that experience of the audience hating it. So as a writer, you never really get that experience, do you? Someone reads a book, you're not there with them. And would you want to be?
No. Yeah.
So it's nice that at least, and especially people like Smith and Lovecraft, who were not exactly megastars in their day, were they, you know?
No, you say that, though. Look, most of the letters are saying more Smith, more Lovecraft, more Howard.
Yeah, but they're interesting.
They're getting
that feedback from the Weird Tales readers, at least. At least they were getting that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That satisfaction.
Yeah, definitely.
Because it doesn't, they weren't getting that from the editors, were they?
No.
It almost sounds like, yeah, I suppose we'll put the Call of Cthulhu in. I suppose it's okay. It's a bit weird, isn't it? It's a bit weird.
Well, one of the other interesting ones that I found while I was doing this, it wasn't about Smith, but it was a letter from Milwaukee from a young gentleman named Robert Block.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and this was like 1931, so, you know, he would have been very young at this point, Mr. Block. Oh,
like a teenager, virtually. Like,
yeah,
this.
Exactly. And basically, it's keep weird tales weird. he says, yeah, there has been a worrying trend in the last few issues that there's been some very sort of mundane, conventional stories, and weird tales should be about the weird, damn it. You know,
Wow.
I couldn't agree more. You know,
I for one would be listening to Robert Block even at that age. You know, I mean, yeah. We have speculated before about Wright's reasons for doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, he's got to sell a magazine because it's a commercial enterprise, and you know, and Wright had his own struggles. We shouldn't be too hard on him.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
But was there pressure from? I think we were saying to you earlier, the Comics Code type stuff didn't come in till the 50s, 40s, 50s?
Yeah, I would say 50s, early 50s.
I think it's like McCarthyism and all that stuff, wasn't it?
Sort of, I think it was, yeah.
And of course, we've had the Satanic Panic and all that sort of stuff. But I thought, was there like a moral crusade at the time against weird fiction? So Wright felt he had to tone it down a bit? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Perhaps someone out there will know more about it than us on that. It'd be interesting to
find. I guess it'd really just come down to the sort of morality of the age, really. I mean, that's, you know, I don't know. But, yeah, because, you know, like Return of the Sorcerer kind of was too grim for too graphic.
Yeah.
Whereas now, you read the original version, it's really tame compared to...
Oh, compared to body horror stuff today,
yeah,
in books, torture porn and all that horrible stuff.
Interestingly, the last one that I found today was actually about Return of the Sorcerer. So this is from Strange Tales, the June 1932 issue, because Return of the Sorcerer appeared in the first ever issue of Strange Tales. The letter is from an A. Lewis in Clairton, Pennsylvania. Return of the Sorcerer is perhaps the best story in the issue and comes nearest to having the qualities most sure to awaken interest and suspense, realistic impossibility, the paradoxes more apparent than real, judicious narration, and the sense of restraint in the midst of frenzy that goes far to give the story a genuine ring. Yes, I couldn't agree more.
Totally.
Yeah, so this is something I'm going to carry on and do when we go through the other things. I'm going to try and see if there was any sort of mention in any of the letters or anything like that around the time, because I think it's nice to get sort of, because, you know, we're giving the listener our thoughts, so it'd be interesting to see what the thoughts of the time were like and see if they differed at all.
Yeah, that's a really good idea. I look forward to seeing that, yeah. I've just got a couple of short extracts I wanted to read. Well, relatively short, considering it's Lovecraft in one case.
Lovecraft.
And you'd have heard the name August Derleth, of course, over the last two series. A man who, whatever his faults, was instrumental in keeping the Lovecraft flame and the Smithian flame to a large extent alive as well.
Indeed.
I think whatever your views on him, it's a simple fact that without Derleth, we probably wouldn't be doing this show. We wouldn't be organising conventions and, you know, all the rest of it.
Yeah, very true. I'd just also very quickly like to mention, yeah, because during the series is Rob goes from Dawnwood Spire, Lonely Hill, and I go from the collection of letters between Clark Asher Smith and August Derleth entitled Eccentric Impractical Devils.
Nice. That's an album name, by the way.
Isn't it just?
Yeah. So this is HPL to Smith, and this is from 10 Barn Street, Providence, Rhode Island, October the 12th, 1926. So this is sort of reasonably early on in their correspondence. Which reminds me that I have just discovered a boy of 17 who promises to develop into something of a fantasist. He is August W. Derleth, whose name you may have seen as author of some rather immature stories in Weird Tales. Finding my address through the magazine, he began corresponding with me and turns out to be a veritable little prodigy, devoted to Dunsany and Arthur Machen and ambitious to excel in the chosen field. He is entering the University of Wisconsin this fall and has a room only a few doors from where Galpin roomed where he first corresponded with you, 823 West Johnson Street, Madison, Wisconsin. I know he'd be glad to hear from you if you ever have time to drop him a line or send him a few of your current poems. So that's nice. That's part of this circle again where Lovecraft discovers, in inverted commas, this young writer. The young writer has written to him. He puts him in touch with Smith. Yeah. And so the circle expands.
The modern thing of like, oh, I've passed on your email, doesn't really have the same romance, does it? You know.
Well, no. And I mean, when we're long gone and someone's doing a podcast about us.
That'd be funny.
So there was these two Burks in late, what were we in early 21st century England.
Yeah.
But none of our sparkling repartee and correspondence back and forth will be available because it's all on email and by then.
Messenger.
Yeah, who knows where it will be by then. That's a weird thing, isn't it? Someone might be listening to this in 50 years' time. That's quite a strange thought. Oh, I've come over all cosmic. I got a little shiver. Anyway, enough about us. So I just wanted to finish with this one as well, with the letters, because it's just Lovecraft again, really. And this starts with Smith. This is Auburn, California, February the 17th, 1930. I shall send you a little box in a day or two containing some pieces of dinosaur bone. They are from the side of a railroad cut 10 miles above Auburn. The outlines of the creature are plainly to be seen, rearing for 20 feet where it was overtaken by some ancient glacier, which of course is something that Smith would later use in the story. It is, of course, in a very advanced state of disintegration. Otherwise, it would have been removed long ago to a museum. I think these fragments will stir your imagination. Well, he wasn't wrong.
It's Lovecraft, isn't it? Here we go.
Because this is Lovecraft's response. 10 Barn Street, Providence, Rhode Island, February the 27th, 1930. And now let me thank you most profoundly and eloquently in advance for those bits of dinosaur bone which you mention as being tentatively en route. Nothing could be more appropriate to my tastes or more stimulative to my fancy. To think of having by me the mortal remains in part of a 20-foot-high thing which lumbered about the primal Pacific morasses 50 million years ago, a thing which may have trod the vari-coloured sands of Lemuria and nosed amongst the fallen obelisks of the older ones, a beast on whose broad back great Cthulhu himself may have ridden from his palace in blasphemous Riolier. My friend Morton of the Patterson Museum will envy me bitterly and long will pull a pretty wistful face when I tell him of my good fortune. Both Long and I are dinosaur fans and of identical bas-reliefs of the Tyrannosaurus rex, which we purchased at the American Museum of Natural History. Again, my profoundest gratitude.
That's amazing. I didn't realise that him and Long were dinosaur buffs, because I know when we covered Dreamer on the Night Side in the IBC, we mentioned them going to the museum both buying bloody bar reliefs of tight T-Rexes.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of fits when you think about it, doesn't it? The deep time and all that sort of stuff. But that
Cthulhu.
That is going to be on a T-shirt soon.
It's
Cthulhu,
gotta be.
Yeah, Cthulhu riding a T-Rex. Keep an eye out for that one, folks. That's coming.
Cthulhu riding a T-Rex. That is an image that is going to stay with me. That's tremendous.
All right, so let's round off this episode and round off this season with some listener questions and comments. As I said before, apologies if we have missed any of these. Part of the problem is they're scattered across the internet. I mean, technology's great, but now I find there's 15 different ways.
Technology's great, but there's too much of it.
So we're going to start with Twitter, or is it called X now? I'm calling it Twitter. I can't be bothered with all that stuff. And we did mention in the episode, our last episode on Hunters from Beyond, about that iconic cover with the white thing peering around the bookcase. And we didn't know who the artist was for that cover.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Weird Friction wrote to us. You had asked on the Strange Shadows episode about the Hunters from Beyond if anyone knew the artist who painted the cover art for the story was. It's Hans Waldemar Wesselowski. He was a big at the time, but not so remembered artist of the Pulp Fiction era. The art was reused for Rivals of Weird Tales, an anthology that collected the best of the weird Pulp Fiction magazines that were not Weird Tales. And that book, Rivals of Weird Tales, was edited by Robert Weinberg, Stefan R. Szymanowicz, and Martin H. Greenberg, and it was published by Bonanza Books in 1990. I don't think I've seen that book, but I'm going to keep an eye out for that.
No, I'm gonna have a look for that. That sounds something right up my street.
And some other people got in touch to let us know that artist as well, in particular on YouTube, Valzain Lumivix. I hope I've pronounced your name correctly there. Also mentioned that the cover artist was Hans Waldemar Wesselowski. And we've had some other comments in on YouTube as well.
Yeah, on the same episode, which was The Hunters from Beyond, we had a message from Vlekistan, which I believe is Aaron Vlek. Back in the 70s, there were a number of odd, dusty bookstores in San Francisco where anything might happen. Yeah, because you were trying to look if that was a real bookshop, weren't you? There you go.
Yeah, I couldn't find out, but it's nice to know that there were bookshops of that type. I guess it's a given, right, in San Fran.
Oh, it's got to be. Yeah, it's got to be.
Somewhere on Haight-Ashbury or something.
I was going to say, can you imagine in the 60s going to a bookshop on Haight-Ashbury? Oh. that'd be mind-melting sort of situation, wouldn't it? Yeah. We also got a question on the same thing from Darth Klingfilm. Great name, by the way. What is or was your favourite bookshop?
Oh, that's a very good question. That's a very good question. The one that I used to go to the most, because it was local to me, but it also was a very good archetypal secondhand bookshop, was a place called Terry's in Ilford. And you basically got off the bus and you're straight into the bookshop. Not a particularly large place, but they were like almost Hardis-like, weren't they, some of those places?
You've got
all the crap books out the front that are going for 20p, you know, with a plastic sheet over them if it was raining.
That's it.
And then you go in and it gets progressively more interesting the further you go back into the shop.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, by the time you got to the back, there was all the nudie mags and all that stuff.
I was going to say, the cold print room, as we like to call it.
Oh, it's cold print. Yes, of course. But along the opposite wall were like probably three rows of sci-fi, fantasy, horror, from your Pan Book of Horror Stories, all your Sphere, Robert E. Howard books, Moorcock, you know, all that. And it's just like a browser's paradise, really, you know.
Yeah, I've been to some great ones over the years. There was a great one on the Deansgate in Manchester when I was a kid. And it was very similar thing. And me and my mates always used to try and sneak into the back room. You know, when the guy was doing his crossword and not paying attention, we'd sort of sneak in. But there's been like a few over the years. All of that is my sort of favourite type of bookshop, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
There was a great one up until very recently in Worthing, which is sort of next biggish town along the coast from where I live now, called Kim's Books. And that had like the back room was just wall-to-wall fantasy, sci-fi, horror, was but it was part of a chain. There's unfortunately that one isn't there anymore, but the one in Arundel still is, because it's in Arundel. It's in this wonderful little historic old building, and it's really quite narrow but really tall, and you keep going up all these stairs, and all the sci-fi and horror and stuff is in the top. It's almost like in a turret, and if you look out the window you can see Arundel Castle.
Oh, brilliant.
So it's absolutely, it's a great little shop. So yeah, if you're ever in Arundel, pop in Kim's Books. It's well worth a delve.
Nice. And we both mentioned last time that one we've been to as well in Plymouth, right? Down at the Barbican.
Oh, the haunted. The one in Plymouth. Yeah. I was thinking
Cambridge, the haunted bookshop. Yeah, the haunted bookshop was good, but it wasn't that big. I found one.
No, there wasn't a lot in there, to be honest.
I was a little disappointed. I did get a big sort of mammoth book of ghost stories for a fiver.
Yeah, that one on the Barbican in Plymouth, though, that was one of the reasons I used to go to Plymouth.
Yeah.
When I lived there.
That'd be my favourite current one, I have to say. Mm. And yeah, it's not a sight you see very often as well. It used to be every town had that secondhand bookshop, didn't it? But very rarely see.
You are tending to see more nowadays. Like for a while, it was really bad because, I mean, I go around places quite a lot. And what the first thing I do is go and Google if there's any bookshops. And you are finding more and more.
Oh, that's good.
And you are, yeah, you're getting the ones that are more sort of boutique-y and they sell sort of like board games and new books.
Right.
And then you get the proper, like, they're usually tucked away in some like decaying, like indoor market kind of thing, you know, like an old shopping mall, them old 60s shopping malls, them brutalist monstrosities. They're usually a unit, right, tucked down the end next to like a sex shop or something.
Yeah.
And you go in and those are my favourite kind of bookshops. Yeah.
There was one in Peterborough when I lived out in the Fens I used to go in. That was, again, in an odd little old sort of warehouse type place, very dark and dingy inside.
Mm.
And I only went in there once or twice. They did records and comics and books downstairs, and upstairs was a tattooist. It's where I got my tattoo done, actually, was in there. I can't remember the name of it. It's one of those on the tip of my tongue. If anyone out there remembers the name of the place in Peterborough, then do let me know. But that was a good place.
My favourite in Brighton, it's actually a record shop, a huge record shop, like secondhand record shop, and it's been there for like decades and decades. And so every time I go in there, I spend stupid amounts of money. It's called Wax Factor, but it also does sci-fi, fantasy, and occult books. Nothing else.
Oh, nice.
Just sci-fi, fantasy. Like there's a whole wall of sci-fi, fantasy, and horror, and then a whole wall of like down one wall. It's all occult stuff. And then the rest of it is records. So it's like my shop.
That's like a day out for me, you know.
It is. You can be there for hours.
Yeah. All you need is a little greasy spoon next door, and that's me sorted.
They've got one. No, they've got a cafe attached to it, owned by them.
Oh, attached.
Because they've got the main shop. And then they've got a shop, they bought the shop next to it, which is where they have all the singles. So it's 12-inch singles, 7-inch singles. And then the back of that is another unit, which opens onto the street, and it's called the Singles Bar. And it's done like a 1950s cafe.
Oh, nice. Nice.
And they've got little record players and stuff in there. So you can go, you know, go and grab something, go and have a sarnie, go and decide whether you want to buy stuff. Oh, you know, it's great.
Listen to some Gene Vincent or something.
Yeah, it is literally a day out, that shop. It's just down from Brighton Station on Trafalgar Street. So, yeah.
All right. Next time I'm down on the South Coast, then that's going to be on the list.
Yeah, it's a great place.
So thank you, Aaron, as always, for that comment, and thank you. I like the fact that Klingfilm is spelt with a K, Darth Klingfilm.
Yes, that was a nice touch, right?
I can't help feeling there's a story behind that I'd like to hear.
Darth Klingfilm, love it.
Rick Kennett also wrote in on YouTube, and this was on the episode "A Letter from Mohorn Loss," and we were talking about the podcast Voluminous, which I mentioned.
Mm.
And Rick let us know, Voluminous discussed letters between Lovecraft and all of his correspondents, not just Smith. All right, that was my mistake there. Unfortunately, the podcast ceased a few months ago. A real shame. Yeah, I had heard that it stopped. I don't know why. I think it's Andrew Lehman and Sean Branny from the Historical Society. I guess it's a lot of work when you're doing everything else as well.
To be honest, we only really delve into the letters in any great detail when we do these the bonus episodes, and there is a lot of research. There is a lot of
and even then we only tend to extract a paragraph or a few lines. They read the whole letter and then go through it. I mean, yeah.
Oh, blimey! And some of Lovecraft's letters were like. Like you say, they were like novellas, some of them.
Yeah, it's a huge amount of work and picking out all the references and everything else. And speaking of references, the Sith Empire writes, this is on the Testament of Athamaeus episode, great podcast. I look forward to going through your CAS conversations. Thank you very much. As regards Jack Williamson, who, funnily enough, we mentioned just a few minutes back.
Yeah.
So Jack Williamson was considerably more well-known in sci-fi circles and was quite prolific, although his early Legions of Space books, particularly the first one, fall well into the weird fiction category.
Ah.
So that's something else I'll be checking out as well, see if I can maybe get that series of books. They sound quite interesting.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like, yeah, completely unfamiliar with him. But yeah, like you said, weird coincidence there because he was in that. He was the one who won the first place in that month's issue, wasn't he?
So if he topped the Testament of Athamaeus, then, you know, that's got to be something worth reading, right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I love the title of that story anyway, The Wand of Doom. It's a good one, isn't it?
It's a good one. And now this this last comment came in from Charvel 39, our old friend Ben Crawford out there in Tennessee. And this was the City of the Singing Flame episode. Now, I'm going to read this question. You made a comment. It's a very Tim-style comment in response. But I'm going to read this question. When you brought up eSpace, it dredged up suppressed trauma revolving around the accursed Adric. Mathematical excellence, my ass. Now, I read that and I haven't got a clue. You obviously have. What does it mean?
Yeah, my response was, ha, 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 yes, the Cybermen certainly proved that was a load of cobblers. Yes, well, it's talking about 1980s Doctor Who, specifically the Peter Davison era, and specifically the story... Well, basically, Adric was a companion who came in the last couple of stories of the Tom Baker era and carried over into the Peter Davison era. And he was an insufferable little so-and-so. He had a badge for mathematical excellence. Because in his first story, he was this clever, he could compute anything, blah, 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 blah. But it was one of them things that kind of got dropped as it was going along until his final story, Earthshock, which is the Cybermen. And they've got this super freighter. They're going to slam it into Earth and kill like a peace treaty kind of thing. Right. Right at the end of it, Adric is on the bridge and he's got this thing to decode. And it's maths, right? So he's decoding it. He's mathematically excellent, blah, 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 blah. All he manages to do is send this thing back in time so it doesn't wipe out the peace thing. It just wipes out the dinosaurs instead. And he dies. So there you go.
Well, doesn't that link in nicely to our earlier dinosaur bone? Perhaps that was the very thing that killed the dinosaur that Smith then sent to Lovecraft.
There you go. Yeah, it was Adric. There you go. That's what killed that dinosaur. It was Adric and the Cybermen. There you go. I like it.
It's all interconnected.
Indeed.
Yeah, so thanks very much for all those comments and questions. And please do keep them coming in. We'll try and pick them up as quickly as we can. We might be a bit slow sometimes, but we'll get around to reading them out on the show eventually. And, of course, you can drop us an email at innsmouthbookclub@outlook.com. You can post on our YouTube channel, on our Facebook page, or you could try sending a letter through space and time in a gyroscopic time machine to reach us at some point in the future, or maybe even the distant past. Actually, I remember when I was six, I found this letter and it said, "What's your favourite Smith adaptation?" And I thought, what?
So, somebody's got the computation wrong. There you go. Yeah,
they were out by years.
Yeah. Nice.
And of course, you can post comments on our Patreon site as well. Speaking of which, we'd just like to thank our patrons for supporting us over this last season. So a big thank you to Martin Thorison, Dominic Allen, Rachel Parkinson, Ulrich DeVetter, Mark Jenkins, David A. Riley, Gary Pennington, Brett Kramer, Aaron Vleck, Steve Meyer, Wingate Stites, Russell Journey, Justin Woodman, Lee Clark Zumpa, Rick Seam, and of course, Chris Carr. Thank you, Chris. And we'd also like to thank the guests and readers who have appeared on this season as well, including Jeff Goad, Gavin Chappell, Paul Fricker, Simon Bleakin, Shelley DeCruz, Mark Griffin, and the wonderful Greg Johnson. Thank you very much.
Righty-ho. Well, that pretty much brings us to the end of season two. So, yeah, we're going to be taking a very short break before we get cracking into season three. But in the meantime, we will have some bits and pieces for you to get your teeth stuck into. I believe we're going to be doing a few readings and all that kind of stuff. I believe you have something lined up, Rob.
Yeah, when I was looking through the letters for this episode, I found it's almost like a short story that Lovecraft wrote in one of the letters about Sarthogua. I'm not sure if it was when Smith sent him that little idol of Sarthogua.
Oh, nice.
That he put on his mantelpiece. But yeah, I thought that would make a really nice reading. I might have to dislocate my jaw in order to pronounce some of the names in it. But yeah, that's going to be a lot of fun. So yeah, definitely be putting that out sometime over the Christmas holidays. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, I haven't quite decided what I'm going to read yet, but I've been delving into the sort of more obscure end of the Lovecraft circle. So I'm thinking someone along them lines, maybe like C. Wright or Barlow, something like that. Something a bit lesser known, I'm thinking.
And then post-festival season, once all the elder ones have returned to their ancestral spawning grounds, we will, of course, be cracking into season three. And again, of course, this is volume three of the Collected Fantasies, edited by Scott Connors and Ron Hilger. And volume three is A Vintage from Atlantis. Now, we're going to begin, actually, by not looking at the book, but we thought we're long overdue to take a look at the documentary Emperor of Dreams, which has been out for a little while now, and we've not spoken about it yet.
Yeah.
So that's going to be the first episode. And then from there, this is the list of stories we've got lined up for next season. So we're going to start with The Holiness of Azadrak, The Maker of Gargoyles, Beyond the Singing Flame, Seedling of Mars, The Vaults of Yovombis, The Eternal World, Demon of the Flower, The Nameless Offspring, A Vintage from Atlantis, The Weird of Avusul Wuthakwan.
Easy for you to say. I'm glad you got that. I'm so glad you got that. Yeah, then we'll be going on to The Invisible City, The Immortals of Mercury, The Empire of the Necromancers, The Seed from the Sepulchre, The Second Internment, Uber Safla, The Double Shadow, The Plutonian Drug, The Supernumerary Corpse, The Colossus of Lugulun. Lagoon. Yeah, that one. And The God of the Asteroid.
Marvellous. There's some real great stories there, isn't it? Some of Smith's best there.
Yeah. So
we're looking forward to delving into those, and we're looking forward to you joining us as well. We hope you've enjoyed season two. Please do let us know what your favourite stories were. And as always, your comments, suggestions, and questions, and pronunciation corrections.
If anyone can help us out in advance with that one.
There was a Dungeons & Dragons module written around that.
Yeah. Is there really?
Yeah. It's Castle Amber, I think it was called. So I'll definitely be researching into that for that one.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I'll see if I can get a copy, if it's not hideously expensive. But
yeah, we'll see if we can get hold of that. Yeah. It must be a PDF of it or something.
Must be. So that's all the goodness to come next year. Thanks again for joining us on our Smithian journey. Hope you have a great Christmas and a happy new year. With that, it's goodbye from me, Rob Poyton.
And it's goodbye from me, Tim Mendes.